5 o'clock CFRC 101.9 FM, 90.9 on cable, and streaming on the web at www.cfrc.ca. We're broadcasting live from the basement of Crothers Hall at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and you're now tuned into Radio 613. Okay, hello and welcome to the show. My name is Avi. I'm glad you could tune in to Radio 613 this week. We've got a show I'm very much looking forward to. We're going to be speaking with Sean, a show contributor, about solidarity work, and hearing an interview featured first on CKUT Radio in Montreal about the Birthright Unplugged tour, and then we'll be finishing talking about some local solidarity work that's been going on here. But first, we're gonna play some music to get the show started with the Klezmatics from the album Rhythm and Jews. This is the song Hornik Zaft.
Sein Vorn über mir ist, Liebschaft gefällt, sein Vorn über mir ist.
Okay, welcome back to the show, listeners. We started today with some music from the Klezmatics and their album Rhythm and Jews, the song Honigsaft, and that was Bulgar a la Klezmatics. So on today's show, we're going to be talking about some perspectives on solidarity work, and to do so, we have Sean here in the studio, who's done a lot of work, action, and research relating to solidarity work. And welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm very well. How are you?
Not bad. It's a little rainy and dark, but other than that, it's good.
Well, in the basement of the studio, you can't tell. That's the good. Even if it was sunny, we wouldn't be able to tell.
It's always dark in the dungeon.
That's right. Maybe you could just start by telling us some of your sort of personal, but maybe starting with, I don't know if the theoretical experience of solidarity informed your personal experience, but whatever you feel is appropriate, maybe.
Okay, well, I'll tell you the story of sort of how I got involved in doing the theory on solidarity. So for a while, I've been doing solidarity between settlers and indigenous people within North America, and doing research into social movements. A lot of the social movements that I originally started doing research on started moving into the vein of doing solidarity with indigenous people within the last 3 or 4 years. And it interested me as to the way in which that solidarity was functioning from an academic perspective. And I guess it's quite often I'm asked that question of like whether I started doing theory on solidarity before I started doing action. No, I started doing action, and then theory quite often, as it is in critical social movement theory, you quite often go and try and find theory that explains what's going on the ground. So that was sort of the scenario here as well. So one of the things that we started seeing happening is that different social movements from the settler side, that's non-indigenous, started working with indigenous people, specifically around land claims. And you see that come out in BC within the last 10 years, seeing it happen in Caledonia, in Ontario, happened in Tiantanega, it's happened in Kanisatake with Montreal. And so we wanted to look at the way in which people could, from both an indigenous side and a settler side, come together to work across the Great Divide. And so one of the theorists that I went to a conference and someone was talking about Emmanuel Levinas and a book called Totality and Infinity. It's a book from the 50s and 60s. I can't remember the exact date. You'll have to excuse me. Anyways, I read that book, and because someone had referred me to it because of the kind of things I was talking about and thought maybe it might be applicable. And within that book, which is actually fairly heavy philosophical theory, it's pretty intense and hard to grasp, and so you'll have to excuse me if anyone knows better than me and I'm like making a fool of myself. Well, you know, I'm only a master's student, so what can you do? But anyways, this is my version of Emmanuel Levinas.
Maybe you could just tell us quickly some background on who Levinas is.
So Levinas was a philosopher, Jewish philosopher who did predominantly like secular theory. But looking at it in retrospect, you can see it is secular, but you can see that it's quite influenced by his Jewish background. And looking at it even deeper, you can kind of see, I can see that there's a lot of influences, specifically with reference, I think, to Kabbalah and other Jewish traditions that informed the way in which he was thinking about things. And so in Totality and Infinity, it's basically the story of it's a post-Shoah sort of look at the world from the perspective of trying to figure out how exactly the Nazis dehumanized Jews and others, and the same and other relationship within the world, and the way in which, you know, catastrophes happen between same and other, when the same just decides to destroy the other, how that can be averted and how one can look at it. So one of the interesting things I took from there was that, first he sets up the relationship of sameness and otherness and how that process goes forward. And he starts to look at the introduction of otherness into the realm of sameness. So if anyone's lost me, so basically if you're in a predominantly, Christian European context, which is what he's taking as his case study, even though he doesn't specifically talk about it that way, it's sort of fast and loose theory, but it's kind of abstract. But if you're looking into the introduction of Jews into a predominantly Christian European field, there's different sort of reactions that the same can have to the other when they are introduced into the field. And I guess from his work, I took that one of the reactions is that you can try and destroy the other, because the other is deeply linked to ego, right? Other, basically, the little other in Levinas represents the small sort of ego-based human response to other to others coming and interrupting the sameness. So one thing you can do is you remove the sameness, so you can, or the other, you can destroy it and replace it with sameness because the other's gone. You can try and overcode the other, meaning you can try and assimilate and turn the other into you. And from a Jewish perspective, you look at that as conversion and the many programs that were going on to do that throughout, you know, millennia. You can run away from the conflict and pretend it doesn't exist. It would be sort of the denial thing. You can destroy yourself. That doesn't happen very often, as we know. Or you can attempt to entertain into a face-to-face conversation with the other. And that's really what he was talking about, protocols, almost like ways in which that face-to-face could happen. And so then in his philosophy, he brings about a concept of saying that the only way that the face-to-face could happen, where same and other could come to a respectful field and have a discussion, enter into a conversation, is if there's some sort of unifying central great other that was between both the same and the other in the small context. And so in a way, from what I took of what he's talking about, the great other, and he has the capital O for the great other, is in a way much in the same, I link it in the same sense as the Kabbalah and the traditions of like Ein Sof, the great unknowable, the infinity of all things that cannot be known from terrestrial realm. That it's sort of that sort of scenario, that is what links same and other, that both same and other cannot know what's unknowable. And then that in itself is a connection that is, in a way, undercuts ego enough that same and other can have the face-to-face contact, recognize from the first, he talks about a first encounter with the great other that all peoples have, is that this understanding that you, your personal ego, is impinged upon by, cannot ever contain, cannot ever know all that is not knowable about the universe. And that's sort of the first, we'll say, psychological slap in the face that every individual has to deal with, is that they actually cannot be their own sovereign imperial force onto their own, because there are things that are much larger than them. And that the way in which to enter into face-to-face and have a conversation is to have people remind themselves of that scenario and bring that into their minds when they're entering into a relationship with another, and to bring that into there so that it can impinge upon, push down that ego mechanism that can bring about other like horrific things like destruction. So I looked at that and I thought it was, you know, really much relevant for what I was seeing happening in the field with solidarity, specifically between settlers and indigenous people. Because one of the things that people had talked about over and over again within that field was indigenous people and settlers were both saying that one of the first things that needed to happen was that in the context of Canada, we have a state that is basically said has hegemony over all things, and indigenous people have a small but like restrained position with inside that state. So then people who are settlers that consider themselves Canadians, flowing with the national zeitgeist around what it is that they represent or who they are, Indigenous people don't have space to exist within that conception. And in the way that they're actually, that is that very overcoding, that assimilation, which we've seen through history with reference to Canadians or British or French in regards to Indigenous people in this continent. And one of the first things that needs to happen is to have that ego minimization in order that settlers can come to a field of possibilities in their mind, understanding that they don't know everything, that they aren't everything, and then be able to have a face-to-face contact in what I would call like a field of possibilities, which means the thing in their mind that needs to happen is that they need to know that anything is possible, because that great unknowable, that it does exist with reference to humans, means that anything is possible. And if they have a mindset when engaging in relations with another, then anything is possible, then they have to be able to go into that face-to-face encounter, that conversation, knowing that they need to listen to the other, to communicate to them something that they can't prejudge what's going to happen. They can't look at the other and think they know everything about them, based on their own sort of socialization or whatever. So it's kind of going into a state of mind. To go into solidarity is to put yourself in a state of mind. And again, this is the extremely abridged version of like my thesis work, of course, for time restraints. But going into there means that one has a certain humility, I guess, the ability to stop talking and to listen, and to be able to crush down their own ego enough to be able to listen to what the other has to say. And the other will, if they're willing to engage with the process, will speak things that the same has never heard, basically, because the same doesn't hear anything with regards to the other, because there isn't a discourse going on. So this is what we're talking about, building the first dialogue, right? The first conversation between same and other. And so this can happen on a miniature level, like between a few people, and that's kind of things I was studying, specifically with relations to one social movement, engaging with indigenous people, moving away from that sort of Sally Struthers tolerance-based kind of activism and more into actually getting to know people and really figuring out, because they're informed by indigenous people, what they need to do to be able to better work with indigenous people. And it also comes out of like understanding that that same connection is that, like, so like a really a famous quote that says, basically, if you think you're going to come in and tell me, and that meaning like another, like what is best for me or what you're going to do, then you're in the wrong way. Really, if you come to me and say, you know, my liberation is connected with your liberation, is bound up with it, that none of us can be free without each other's being free, then you're on the right track. And this is a way of looking at solidarity that emphasizes that relationship between peoples, that says that there's a connection between liberation of one and another, because part of it is understanding as well that the relationship of people who consider themselves same, inside that sameness is actually many, many crushed others as well. And that the entire ball of sameness is as much a fallacy as anything else. And so what often comes out of these relationships is an unpackaging of, much compressed and crushed down identities. And so it's really interesting doing that work and thinking about it for my thesis. And I thought, like, I was wondering, looking at basically the way in which people are doing solidarity in different realms, that it was very appropriate to come up with a way, looking at from doing interviews and stuff, a way in which solidarity has an etiquette or a protocols. And I guess one of the ways in which that worked was that throughout interviews, people were saying that one of the most important things was that there needed to be personal relationships, and that those personal relationships were different than people, you know, working on a campaign who happened to hear that they could write a petition for someone, or someone coming and deciding that they were going to, like, you know, walk down off the mountain and save some, you know, Sally Struthers sort of model, you know, save the children or whatnot. And really it was about going in and understanding what other people's lives were like, and to be able to hear those voices speak for themselves. And I guess that would, in some ways, necessitates that when you're going in to do that you don't think that you know what should be done already, like I was saying before, with regards to the possibilities.
Maybe we can just, talk in a somewhat more concrete terms as far as, you know, why that's specifically important as far as settler-indigenous relations of having that check on ego and relation with the other and listening. And I'm talking concretely, I mean, you know, what needs to be sort of, you know, broken down as far as our colonial narrative and what informs all of our understanding and action, and, you know, this idea that we really that there could be a whole other world of possibilities of what's out there. And maybe you can just talk a bit more concretely of, you know, what that, you know, why that's necessary, or what that looks like, maybe once that starts to open up, and our own sort of understanding gets shaken a little.
Well, I guess part of it as well, like, you know, leading through my research, it brought me to a reconsideration of history. History is very important in the process with regarding the same and other relationships, especially when they're rooted in history. You know, much like, you know, there's any history between a long-standing conflict between one same and another, like some of the things that had happened throughout history with building of anti-Semitism, you see how that's moved century after century, the rooting in the culture of myths of people from Christian backgrounds, the using of the church. Well, you see similar scenarios arise in the Americas with regards to predominantly the Christian majority's relationship with, you know, I'm not saying I'm letting Jews off the hook completely for that, but you know, we're looking at a Christian majority, and its relationship with indigenous people from the beginning, and not just like French and British colonial relationships, but also moving past into Confederation and looking at the Canadian Confederation as heirs to the groundwork that was laid by the French and British colonial powers. And one of the reasons it's important to look at that in a critical light, for someone who's trying to engage with indigenous people in solidarity work, is that if you don't understand off of the state sort of mandated historical discourse, if you can't break out of that, then you're not ready to listen to what indigenous people have to say. Because a lot of the problem is that people in the sameness category have been free from having to contemplate any of those relationships. They've been free from history. In a sense, a lot of the modern settler sort of world in Canada, the history is irrelevant, and it's becoming frighteningly more so every day. People don't actually think about history, and they aren't made to. And in the indigenous world, that's not the case. Everyday reality is dictated by these past historical benchmarks and things that had happened, the genocides, you know, the thousands and thousands of genocides that had happened all around this land. And for indigenous people, from an indigenous perspective, the landmark is pocked with like marks of genocide, and the earth is soaked in blood. And I think that a lot of settlers can't understand that until they go back and re-examine history. And if they're like settlers who were immigrated here recently, or whose parents immigrated, or grandparents, you know, it takes some looking through history. And for other people who have been here for hundreds of years, it takes the going through their family and looking how their family was implicated and what exactly they did. So going through that process is an important part of solidarity as well. Because, you know, if an individual can come within history, they can come to understand how their history of their families is bound up with the history of indigenous people. And it's almost like a truth and reconciliation process, mm-hmm. I'm talking about in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And that you could go and see that you actually do have a relationship to indigenous people. It has been a negative relationship historically and generationally, but it doesn't have to be that way.
And I think part of that, what's socialized as well, is that separation is, you know, not only are we often not told that the place we live in is on stolen indigenous land, and that's ongoing as well, but that we are kind of taught in a way that compartmentalizes, this is where indigenous people live, this is their world, you know, and we learn a very superficial, perhaps exoticized understanding. They live on here, maybe we learn about reserves, so they live, and that really reinforces, I think, that idea, and it makes it even more difficult, but important to start breaking that down.
Yeah, I mean, there is a psychological component just as strong to the socialization around essentially like racial and ethnic apartheid. That's what essentially is happening in this country. The psychological component is stronger than the material component. The material component is backed up absolutely and completely by the psychological socialization, the way people think, and that unwillingness to engage with the other. And so that's how we get back to this engaging with the other, those first steps. We're talking the first baby steps in this country about these issues. And I think with relationship to this one group that I saw recently that was doing some work on that I thought emphasized maybe some of those first steps, some of with regards to doing solidarity, was some work that was happening with a group called Birthright Unplugged in regards to taking people to Israel, predominantly of Jewish background, and meeting with Palestinians and having that face-to-face encounter. And, you know, setting up, not that it's necessarily going to happen, but setting up the background, providing the atmosphere where those kind of encounters could first happen. So I think, you know, we have a clip.
We do, yes. Yeah. So this is from CKUT Radio in Montreal, interviewing someone who organizes tours with Birthright Unplugged.
I'm on the phone with Hannah Mermelstein, who is one of the organizers of the Birthright Unplugged tour. She joins us from Boston. Welcome to the program, Hannah.
Thank you.
To get started, can you explain what Birthright Unplugged is for our listeners?
Yes, Birthright Unplugged is an educational project primarily seeking to expose young Jewish people, mostly North Americans, to realities of Palestinian life under occupation. And we take people, our participants, on six-day trips through villages, cities, and refugee camps, mostly in the West Bank. We actually cross the Green Line into what is now Israel for one day to also visit destroyed villages from 1948. So we get a wide variety of Palestinian experience and meet with a lot of different people.
What do you see as the importance of this trip? It is a trip for Jewish youth designed to bring them into the Palestinian territories. How do you see the importance of this trip for its participants?
I think in the world in general, there is both a lot, and specifically in North America, there's a lot of misinformation about what's happening in Israel and Palestine, and also there are a whole lot of opportunities for young Jewish North Americans to visit Israel on free trips, fully funded trips, like Birthright Israel as well as others, and they don't show them anything about the reality of Palestinian life. So it's a trip to Israel to develop a love for the land and the people of Israel, but not at all any of the Palestinian inhabitants of Israel or crossing the Green Line into the West Bank or Gaza Strip. So I think a lot of the people who go on those trips are people who are pretty open-minded, don't necessarily know a lot, are going for the free trip, and probably would be interested in having a more broad and fuller experience. So we provide that for people.
Mm-hmm. And obviously the name Birthright Unplugged is kind of modeled off of that name Birthright Israel, but it's quite different. In fact, you're not affiliated at all with Birthright Israel. Maybe you could kind of compare and contrast in a bit more detail those two experiences, one that someone would get on a Birthright Israel trip versus on the Birthright Unplugged trip.
Well, I myself have not been on a Birthright Israel trip. I have been growing up. I grew up in a labor Zionist youth movement, and I did go to Israel with this youth movement several times. So I think I've done a lot of the similar things to what Birthright Israel does, but I haven't actually been on a Birthright Israel trip. And I want to point out also that Birthright, it's not only a takeoff on the name Birthright Israel, but just the concept of Birthright in general, that the concept of a Jewish birthright to this place, even as millions of Palestinian refugees are not allowed to return to their homes, that we just feel it's important as Jewish people to oppose this very strict definition of birthright applying only to Jewish people. In terms of the trips, what I've heard, we started our trips, our Birthright Unplugged trips, last July, and half of the people who came on our trip had just been on a Birthright Israel trip. So what we heard from them is that on Birthright Israel, there's a lot of sort of development of love for the Jewish state, for Israel, for the land, for the country, a lot of touristy things, a lot of building relationships with people, not a lot of serious discussion about politics. So most people said they weren't really inundated with negative images of Palestinians as much as no images of Palestinians. And that's something I think is pretty significant and is also indicative of my experience growing up, is that I wasn't necessarily taught a lot of bad things about Palestinians, just nothing. So it was sort of this completely ignoring and denying the history of the indigenous people. And I think that's a lot of what Birthright Israel does. Now, the other thing to say about Birthright Israel is that they contract out their trips. So each one is different because they are done by different people and different organizations. So some of them are more political than others. Some of them are more outdoorsy. But what they all have in common is that they do not meet with Palestinian people, certainly not in the West Bank at all, and don't learn about life under occupation. And they're missing a huge part of the story.
Birthright Israel, of course, they've been doing in the past 5 or 6 years of their existence, they've managed to bring thousands of young Jewish people to Israel, and they do get a considerable amount of funding from different Jewish communities throughout the world, and also from wealthy donors. So they're able to do a considerable amount of outreach. I'm curious to know how your program has managed to do outreach, and whether you've found considerable support within Jewish communities for what you're doing.
Well, the organization is very new, so that's the first thing to say. Our first trips were in July, and a lot of the outreach has happened word of mouth. We sent out an email announcement, but ultimately all of the people who contacted us had gotten it at least second or third hand, or even further. There are people who found out about the trip who told us how they found out, and we have no idea how the people who told them found out about it. So a lot of it has been word of mouth and forwarding of announcements. We are actually currently fundraising also to continue to run the trips. We've only gotten one grant so far. We've also been supported largely by private individual donations, and are just working to sort of keep going. So it's a new organization, and the hard part about, I think, raising money for an organization like this is that a lot of Jewish organizations don't really want to touch it, because it deals with Palestinians and is in the West Bank. And non-Jewish organizations tend to, because it's a Jewish project, say, well, there's enough Jewish funding out there for Jewish projects. So that's the quandary we're in. But I think that ultimately, when we do more work on it, we will be financially in a stable position.
Just glancing at your website, birthrateunplugged.org, you and your partner, Dunya, who organize these trips, are coming from very interesting backgrounds as people, and also as activists who've been working in the United States, but also in Palestine. Can you talk a bit about your background as a person or as an activist, and what led you into wanting to do work like this program?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can do both. I can start as a person. Like I said, I grew up in a labor Zionist youth movement, which basically means learning the values of both socialism and Zionism. So a lot of the social justice values that I learned were from this youth movement, but also a lot of the Zionist values that I now consider to be contradictory with my social justice values also came from the same place. So I went to Israel several times with Habonim, with this youth movement, and it wasn't really until the Second Intifada in 2000, I was in college, it wasn't really until then that I started to question and find myself in conversations with people that I agreed with on everything else. I was doing social justice organizing around a lot of different issues, and then we would have a split on this issue. And finally, I entertained the idea that maybe I was wrong about some things, and there were things that I hadn't thought through completely. And I looked back, I started to learn more and read different narratives than what I had been exposed to when I was younger, and got to the point where I wanted to express solidarity with Palestinian people, recognizing the power dynamic there, recognizing that Israel is controlling its entire civilian population and they're living under occupation, and that I, as an American and as a Jew, have a big responsibility in that. So I went first with the International Women's Peace Service, and both Dunya and I, that's how we met, is that we were both working with the International Women's Peace Service, which does a lot of human rights and humanitarian work in the Salfit region of the West Bank, as well as supporting Palestinian nonviolent resistance, which takes a lot of forms, but recently has been a lot of demonstrations against the wall, which is encroaching upon that area. It's coming 22 kilometers east of the Green Line into the West Bank. So we did a lot of work with IWPS, and then there were delegations that would come through, and we would lead them around sometimes on day trips around our area. And both of us got to know other areas a little bit more, and through various circumstances had started to lead other delegations on more broader trips around. But neither of us had ever done an explicitly, specifically Jewish delegation before. And we were talking last summer, last July of 2004, about the fact that there are so many opportunities for young Jewish North Americans to come on these fully funded trips to Israel, and that they're specifically targeted for state objectives. And we thought, you know what, some of these people would probably be interested in learning something else. So that's how the idea of Birthright Unplugged was born.
This is a 6-day trip, and for $350 American, people get walked through quite an interesting itinerary. Can you take us through those 6 days and give us an idea of what Birthright Unplugged would entail?
Sure. So we meet in Jerusalem, in the Old City, and we have our orientation there. So we do some training, some cultural training, and just sort of getting to know each other and developing the group a little bit. And then we have a talk that's kind of a political briefing from somebody who works with the Palestinian Negotiation Support Unit, who can give sort of this overall political talk that's probably expressing different things than overall political talks that people have gotten either the previous week on other tours or in other education that they've had. And so we start with that, and then the next day that night we have a Shabbat dinner, or if it's not on a Friday, just a dinner with Israeli activists. So we think it's important, although people have been exposed to Israelis a lot, they haven't necessarily been exposed to Israelis who work in solidarity with Palestinians. So we have a dinner and a panel with Israeli activists working on a variety of issues. The next morning, we turn to the West Bank. So we go to Bethlehem first, and we spend half of the day looking at Bethlehem as a city that's now three-quarters closed by the wall. So we look at the wall. We take a tour of the wall in the Bethlehem area, and we also spend half the day in the Dehesha refugee camp, which has a lot of really interesting projects going on, and also I think is an eye-opening experience for people to see this is what a refugee camp is. These are the issues that these people are talking about, and this is what they're feeling about everything that's happening. And we do, one of the organizations has a circus troupe, so we see them perform their circus acts as well as their improv theater about their daily life. So some of it's funny and entertaining, some of it's really poignant, like the Checkpoint improv theater that they do, for example. And then we stay with Palestinian families in the camp and around the camp in Bethlehem. So we have a homestay, and it's for that night and the next night with the same family, so they can develop some sort of relationship with people. And the next day, we go to Hebron, to Khalil. And that's a city that is very extremely under occupation in a different way than most of the West Bank, with the exception maybe of Jerusalem, in that settlers are actually living inside the city, inside the same building sometimes as Palestinians, just taking over the top floors. So we have a Palestinian tour guide take us around and just show us the issues for the people living in Hebron. We also visit a family who lives in a neighborhood that's been almost entirely taken over by Israeli settlers, and his kids every day get stoned by the settlers as they go to school. His daughter's 9-year-old daughter, a couple weeks before we got there to visit last time, had been kidnapped by the settlers for about a half hour or so by the settler kids. So some really intense issues that just walking around and meeting people, this is what we're exposed to. So that's day three. And then we go back up to Bethlehem, to Dehesha, and stay with the families again. And day four, we head back towards Jerusalem and have a tour of the wall and settlements in the Jerusalem area. And that tour is given by ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. So we have this tour, and then we go up to Ramallah. And passing from Jerusalem to Ramallah is an experience all of on its own, which is going through the Calandia checkpoint, which is being more and more institutionalized and made more and more permanent with the structures that are being built and also the wall that's coming up to the checkpoint. So we go into Ramallah, and we meet with a representative from the Palestinian Authority as well as a conflict resolution organization. So those are two meetings that we do in Ramallah. And with the conflict resolution organization, it's young people also, so it's one of the only experiences they get where it's their Palestinian peers that they're meeting, and so we have dinner with this organization. After that, we go back to Jerusalem to sleep. The next day, we go up to the north, and this is the region that Dunya and I know the best because it's where we work with the International Women's Peace Service, and this is the Salfit region. So we go and we visit the International Women's Peace Service. We also visit a family that's completely surrounded by the wall, and we also visit a Palestinian women's organization and girls' organization that are working both to fight against the occupation, demonstrations against the wall, and also confidence building and leadership development among themselves within their own society. So we visit with them, and we sleep in that area that night. And then the next day, which is our last day, day six, we go into the, we cross the Green Line for the only time, and we go west of the Green Line into Israel. We go to the Nazareth area and also Ein Hod. Ein Hod is a very interesting village because it was not destroyed in 1948. All of the residents were expelled, but most of the buildings still remain. And a couple of years later, Israelis moved in and established an artist colony there. So it's a Jewish-Israeli artist colony now, and all the Palestinians who were expelled fled to a hill that's a couple kilometers up the hill, still called Ein Hod, their community, and their village was unrecognized until a couple years ago, meaning they didn't have water, electricity, any of these services that the government provides. And so we learn from them, from these internally displaced refugees who may have Israeli citizenship but don't necessarily have the rights that Jewish Israelis have. So we learn about that, and then we go to Nazareth and a village near Nazareth called Seforia, where that has been completely destroyed. So we see a picture from the 1940s of all these houses on the hill, and we go look at the hill, and now it's all these pine trees that have been planted by the Jewish National Fund, which I think is a poignant moment for a lot of the participants of our trip, and was for me the first time I saw it, because I grew up, like many North American Jews, putting quarters in these little boxes in my synagogue that said, plant a tree in Israel. And now I know where those quarters went and what those trees were, where those trees were being built and why. And then we go back to Jerusalem and we have our closing dinner. And we talk about the future, keeping in touch, making commitments for what people feel like they can do, whether it's, you know, organizing something on a campus or just talking to their parents about the experience, whatever it is that people are able to do as they come back to the States or Canada.
And what are you hoping that participants do walk away from the trip with?
We do as much as possible to expose people to the reality of Palestinian life, and we are hoping that people are open enough to experience it. I think it's pretty impossible to spend 6 days hanging out with Palestinians in the West Bank and not have an incredibly moving experience. So we basically just facilitate this experience. We hope that people walk away with more of a sense of truth and honesty about the situation, and a commitment to bringing justice, however they see that justice can be brought. There are different campaigns that I find inspiring in the States that if people, and in Canada, that if people got involved with, we'd be happy, but we're not specifically pushing people in any particular direction with that.
So that's Birthright Unplugged. You have two trips that are coming up in the near future. One is from January 1st to the 6th, 2006. Then the next starts January 10th to the 16th. Can you give us some information how people can get in touch if they're interested in Birthright Unplugged?
Yes, you can visit our website at birthrightunplugged.org, and all of the information about how to apply, the application, and our email address is all on that site.
Okay, great. We've been speaking with Hannah Mermelstein, who is one of the founders of Birthright Unplugged and an organizer, speaking with us from Boston. Thank you so much for being on the phone with us today, Hannah.
Thank you, Aaron.
Okay, so that was an interview with Aaron from CKUT and Hannah from Birthright Unplugged. And we're going to sort of finish the show speaking about some local solidarity work that myself, Sean, other people are engaged in, especially with regard to our positions as white allies in anti-racist struggles here in Kingston and on campus. It's been a really incredible flurry of ongoing racist, Islamophobic events and atmosphere that's perpetuated here at Queens, you know, on a daily level, but some specific instances, and talking within the context of Islamic History Month, actually, that was going on, and in the span of that time, two break-ins of the Queen's University Muslim Student Association office, one with a saw. There was a vandalism of the Kumsa poster saying all Muslims should die. There's been ongoing reports of harassment of women of color, hijabi women wearing hijabs, and you know, most recent, perhaps most recently, I mean, I shouldn't say that because it's really an ongoing thing, but the president of arts and science faculty here at Queen's commented on a picture of two white women wearing scarves, and he said in his comment online, "Nice Taliban picture." So there's a very intuitive, I think, reaction to this comment and placing it as a really expressing really racist Islamophobic ideas. And we had an ASIS assembly yesterday where a lot of students came out to call for Jacob Mantle, the president of Arts and Science faculty, to resign from his position, as he's no longer a legitimate representative, especially in the fallout of his really unwillingness to try to come to an understanding of what kind of power this statement had, and unwillingness to, again, not only just apologize, but really do that work that we were talking, you know, Sean was talking about earlier, of listening and understanding the experience, and that his experience as a white man on this campus really needs to be placed within the context of power and privilege and that holds, and understanding the experiences of marginalized people here. And that's really not happened. In fact, it's been the opposite, and he's tried to situate himself as a victim here just because people have called him out for his you know, this sort of comment. So, you know, there are a lot of people, and it's, you know, we were engaged last week. There was a workshop that Sean was at, talking about some of the solidarity work and what that involves for people, white people, people racialized as white, and what that involves. And so that was, I think, a really fruitful discussion. We also talked a little bit about anti-Semitism and Islamophobia and incorporating those into anti-racist movements. So we're just going to finish the show. Well, we're going to have some announcements at the end of the show, but we're just going to feature here Safia, who spoke at the Arts and Science Assembly yesterday, and speaking about some of her experiences on this campus.
So I don't know who I'm talking to, whether or not I'm talking to the student body or to the ASIS assembly, but I guess I'm talking to everyone, and I'm talking on behalf of a Muslim student on this campus who's telling her story. I'm not talking on behalf of Kumsa, but just my experiences. So that's for the journey. So really, this is the first time that I've really spoken about this issue publicly at ASIS Assembly previously, and also at AMS Assembly. I personally chose not to speak because, as many of you know, this freedom of speech thing is not really afforded to myself, because, as I'm sure you've heard before, our comments are written off as us being too emotional or us being hypersensitive and not being able to use our own rationality in determining these issues, which I think just writes us off and it doesn't grant me my freedom of speech. So I'm going to be talking about this issue in a less abstract way, which I think is being discussed very abstractly. So I think it needs to be discussed on how it actually does affect people's lives, including my own. So please do listen to me earnestly with an open mind and with some understanding, because I've made this decision to speak to you after a long time. So I guess on the first, I'll start about the story from the beginning, where on the first Thursday of classes, that's the first week of school, I was walking by University and Union, and someone drove by me and yelled, "You're an effing Taliban," from the car very angrily. So originally, I didn't really think much about this issue. And then the next day that I heard that a friend of mine, she was on campus, and someone drove by her and yelled, "Let me unwrap you." So I originally understood these issues to be isolated and so I wrote an editorial for the journal about the issue and how Islamophobia does exist at this campus, and to discuss it and be respectful of each other. However, just before my article was about to go to print, I found out that our prayer space had been broken into, and around the same time a sign had had been defaced that said all Queens Muslim students should die. So I, at that point, understood that this was not an isolated incident. These were not isolated incidents, and that people, there was actually a real problem with Islamophobia on this campus, so much so that people are calling for our death and breaking into our prayer space in a manner that is very, very, very calculated. So we started, so the Anti-Islamophobia Task Force was launched at this point. So after that, the harassments just continued. People got more and more violent in the things that they yelled. They continued to cuss at us. They continued to call us terrorists and Taliban. They told us to go back to where we came from, which for me is Scarborough.
Scarborough!
So imagine how it felt when we found out that the president of the Arts and Science Undergraduate Society had made a comment that likened my dress, my identity, to a terrorist organization, a violent group, and made a connection that people are yelling at us from the side of, like, while we're trying to walk home. I'm not saying that those two things are, you know, they cause each other, cause and effect, but I'm saying that the same connection was made, just that happened to me on the first Thursday of classes. And so when I first heard those comments, I did think that it was a very irresponsible, insensitive, and kind of hurtful comment, but I never thought that, I just thought that it was unintentional. But the moment that I found out that Mr. Mantle was resistant to apologize just changed my perspective entirely. Okay? We've been dealing with people calling for a death, and we created the task force to deal with these issues, and we're getting support from outside, and someone doesn't understand the problem with making the connection that is affecting our everyday life. Okay, that the fact that he didn't want to apologize and didn't understand the problem of making a comment like that, I think reflects very poorly for me and other Muslim students on this campus and people who deal with this stuff every day. So when I last asked this assembly, when you were talking about how it was a really rough week for you, a rough week for ASSIS Council, and you guys couldn't sleep, well, that's been our past 3 months. Really, like, you can ask Stephanie Simpson of Human Rights Office, you can ask my professors how this has affected my experience at this university. You might be a brown student at this university, but try putting a headscarf on your head and walking down, not even being able to walk down. So then, right after Mr. Mantle said that he wasn't going to resign, I know that for a lot of people, this issue just kind of ended. I think seeing the turnout today, how many people think that it doesn't matter anymore. Well, right after the next day, on that Friday, we, as in the visible Muslim students on this campus, meaning the girls who have been continually harassed since the semester began, felt the repercussions. The next day, on the Friday, the day after, when I was trying to go home so I can leave this university for a break, a group of six or seven guys followed us and continued to yell very offensive things. Similarly, and then the next day, some of the girls went downtown because someone graduated and they wanted to celebrate her graduation. And someone came right up to their face and very angrily started yelling offensive things. They had to be restrained in that they were yelling, you know, you're a bad effing Muslim, you killed my friends and family, and just all this bad stuff. And like, it occurred right after, like, we could see the effects right away. Before, people were yelling things from the car and driving away. But at this point, people are coming to our faces and doing it. They're unashamed. It's somehow been legitimized, their prejudice. And so I understand that Mr. Mantle has since apologized, which some may think to be too little too late. But an apology really only really means stuff if there is action and stuff to follow. And I haven't seen any accountability, which is something that was on your platform that you ran under, that I voted under. Accountability, and I haven't seen that since last ASSIS assembly. There's just, how do I know that you're making amends? I haven't seen anything concrete, and I think it's been what, you had 3 weeks to prove yourselves, and if you're really a leader, if you're really taking a leadership role, then really, where is leadership? I don't see any now. I don't feel that I'm being represented as I'm supposed to be as a student of this, as a constituent of this faculty society, and I know that a lot of people also don't feel represented, and I don't feel like you have, or rather Mr. Mantle has properly filled his role in and that you really alienated a lot of people in your faculty society, and thereby only feel that it's apt that you do resign. And I say this on behalf of myself, and I wish I had said it earlier, but I didn't feel comfortable saying it until now. Actually, I don't feel comfortable saying it now. But anyways, and that you need to understand, well, Mr. Mandel and the whole society needs to understand that this issue is affecting people on a very personal, everyday level. It reached a point where we are not allowed to go downtown anymore because people continue making these associations. And if I don't feel comfortable with ASSIS, then I don't think that ASSIS is doing a very good job. I don't feel the same. Thank you.
Okay, that's a highlight from yesterday's ASSIS assembly. And to learn more about what's going on campus with regard to anti-racism, check out the website of Queen's Coalition Against Racial and Ethnic Discrimination, qcred.org. You can also learn about the resignation, not impeachment campaign, calling for Jacob Mantle's resignation. That's it for Radio 613 for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. Tune in next week.